Hello everyone, welcome to F1 Explains. I'm Christian Hugill, and if you're new to us, this is the official Formula One podcast that answers your questions on the best sport in the world. You can email us about anything, f1explains@f1.com, and we will find the best people in the paddock to answer them. Or not in the paddock, in the case of this week's episode. Instead, it was recorded about a 10-minute walk from the paddock in Australia. We went out of the gates, across a fan zone, past a metal gate guarded by a stern-looking Australian man, up some incredibly unglamorous-looking stairs, and in to the commentary box.
The pre-season favourite begins with a win. George Russell wins the Australian Grand Prix. It's a Mercedes 1-2 in a season opener for the first time since 2019.
We don't just answer questions about on-track stuff on this podcast. We also talk a lot about the wider world of Formula One, including how the people who describe the action to us do their job. You've sent us a lot of questions on this one over the years we've been doing this podcast. Alex Jakes is F1 TV's main commentator. He's also heard on Channel 4 in the UK and Apple TV in the United States, as well as all over the world on F1's social media channels. And this is what happened when, back in Australia, he invited us into his home away from home of a race weekend. Alex Jakes, thank you for welcoming us in to your commentary box home. It's lovely to be here.
Well, thank you so much for having me back on the pod once again. And yeah, welcome to the living room.
I've got a few thoughts. There's no house plants, potted plants, picture frames. You could have made it a bit more homely for the weekend, is all I would say.
This is luxury. We are currently sitting in a double box at Albert Park. Let me tell you, some of the commentary boxes around the Formula One World Championship are way more proximate, let's say.
Proximate is a good word.
Than this one, where there are some, I'm thinking Monaco, I'm thinking Miami, where yes. you are, it's honestly like being on a very, very crammed budget airline.
Yeah, sure. Right?
So, and you're not allowed to move. So obviously you're locked in. So this is, I can tell you, luxury.
Excellent. This has got strong airs of you don't know you're born territory to it, doesn't it? I want to start this.
Hey, if you're going to come to a commentary box and ask me about commentary, number one, it's going to be a two-hour podcast.
This is the place to do it, Alex Jakes. You picked the right time and, in fact, the place. Now, I want to start with Becky from Southampton. Hello to you, Becky. Becky emailed f1explains@f1.com. And Becky said, my question is around F1 broadcasting. I've always been fascinated as F1 commentary is nothing like football or cricket or many other sports because the commentators can't possibly see everything all the time. So how is it done? What visual and audio feeds do you get inside the commentary box? What data do you have access to? And how do you coordinate and adapt to whatever the audience can see and hear? I think this is the perfect place to start. So thank you, Becky. Alex Jakes, paint a picture, if you will. Talk us through your commentary box setup. What can you see in front of you?
Well, the first thing to say is that I've got my central monitor here, which is what everyone sees at home. The feed for Formula One, doesn't matter what country you watch on, doesn't matter what channel you watch on, when we have the titles and you see the rundown 5 minutes before the race begins, everyone is watching the same pictures. And therefore, we have exactly what you see at home in the middle of the box.
Because there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's 9 TV monitors in this commentary box. And that one that Alex has just described is a big one in the middle.
And we'll refer to that. So the one in the middle of the 9. So let's take you from left to right in the commentary box. We've got a backup one in case the main monitor breaks.
Okay. Excellent.
So that is just in worst case scenario.
That's the old reserve car from back in the day of Formula One.
Exactly. Then we have a timing page 3, which is a direct race control. So if there is a penalty, if there is a delayed start, if there is anything from race control from the FIA, we get it on that timing page. It comes up in bright purple. So sometimes if it's a crazy race, you might miss it. And then you're like, it came up in bright purple. That really is directly on me. Mm. You also get the basic information about the temperature and the weather conditions and the wind direction on that page. The page below is an old school timing page, which will just tell you the order and the sectors. It's been in use since the early 90s And it hasn't changed because the easiest way to upset this row of commentators that we're sitting on is by changing something sure. that we've always had.
And we should say that system has been in place since the 90s, not this particular monitor. No, that looks slightly newer. No. Not much newer, I would say, but third slightly newer.
Third time page. The next one is to say we have a driver tracker where each driver comes up as a dot. So this is your GPS of where the driver is on the circuit. This is to get around the aforementioned problem of not being able to look out the window and see the entire plot, like a cricket pitch, like a football pitch, like a rugby pitch, like an NFL pitch, where you can see everything if you look. I cannot stand up and have a look out of the window at the entire place, so the driver tracker is very useful for that. Then you get into different timing pages. So Jolyon and David have a different timing page here on the right that gives you slightly different detail. I prefer one which lays it out a different way. This is just us seeing exactly the same information, what tyres they are on, what their previous best lap was, what their current lap time is, what the best sectors are at the bottom. This is just the same information relayed in different visualisations.
And is that a comment? So, for example, next door you might have your esteemed colleague, David Croft,
yes,
from Sky Sports, for example.
Yeah.
Might, doing the same job, might they have it laid out a bit differently?
Yeah, and it's just the way that your brain works and getting the information very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And the page I have in front of me is designed purely, I have that one in front of me and then the old school one. That one is for the opening lap because that is the one that my brain responds to. So when you're rapid fire and you're listing very quickly and you're looking for changes in the order, I respond to that one. The other two chaps in the box, they respond to this one.
It's like working out your own setup, if you like. This is the way I like it.
Entirely, entirely. And so you need the speed of that at the start of the race. And then above their timing page on the other side, I'm greedy. I have four screens directly in front of me. They have three screens in front of them, one of which is a return monitor to the UK commentary box, currently occupied by Alex Brundle. He's just going about his day. He has no idea we're looking at him. It's strange.
It's
downright odd.
Because we're recording this in Australia. So there's where we're, and here we are in the morning. There's Alex Brundle in the dead of night.
Yeah.
On his own, doesn't know we're talking about him or watching him and that he's featuring in this podcast.
Bless him, but he is. And at the top is the tyre page, how long you've been on the tyres.
Excellent, excellent. What a fabulous description. Anybody, you think you describe things for a job. We will get to grips with commentary throughout this episode, but let's start more broadly. How has your prep for the 2026 season compared to previous years? Because it's a new era. There's been lots for us to get used to watching at home. Presumably there's stuff for you to get used to in describing the sport as well.
Yeah, I would say that the difference from 2025 to 2026 is when you have so many new rules, you've obviously got to learn how they work for teams and drivers and the practicality of how they're going to execute those rules. But you cannot possibly describe it the same way that they would, because we're going out to a very broad audience in different countries. We go out from this commentary box to Channel 4 in the UK, the free-to-air network TV highlights. We go out to Apple TV in the States as of this year, and we have a fantastic, knowledgeable, loyal subscriber base on F1 TV.
So you might have some experts and some newbies, if you will.
Also, we're on the YouTube highlights and social media as well. So your explanation has got to work in a way where you bring along the seasoned petrol head and you bring along someone that might have just discovered it in the last month. That is, at the nub of it, the challenge of commentary. And this year, oh my word, it's a challenge. Mm. Because we're taking highly complex stuff and I'm trying to explain it in a way that my mum can understand, in a way that a diehard petrol head would understand, and I'm trying to get to it as quickly as possible and then let my co-commentators, I'm just trying to give you the headline and let the co-commentators do the context if required. Whittling that down from the massive set of regulations down to something that I can hopefully explain in one sentence, that has been the biggest challenge going into this season's new rules.
And does your mum think you're doing a good job?
And she will tell me if I'm not. No, she's phenomenal. And very, very supportive.
Our regards to Mrs. James. We wish her well. Now, Alex, from your point of view, what's it been like commentating on these new cars in competitive sessions? Has it felt different at all?
Now, the first thing I did when I went to Bahrain testing is went trackside. I was like, well, if it's going to be different, I want to know the reality.
Yeah,
did not think in any way went to different corners of the circuit, didn't think it was any different at all. Obviously, sometimes when they're in the longer race runs and they're having to recharge, you're seeing slightly different speeds compared to what you're used to. I think you get used to it very quickly. A lot of the time, though, the commentary gets divided up into what's happening and why it's happening. So when there is so much to explain, when there's a lot of explanation, you've got to be careful to not turn it into a university lecture.
Yeah, of course.
Because it's sport and it's people's weekends and everyone wants to have a good time. So the complexity of it is there, but it's Formula One. It's a traditionally quite complex sport anyway.
Something I actually don't think Formula One as a sport gets enough credit for is its TV graphics. Because now, Alex, you and I are both huge soccer fans, football fans.
Yeah.
But the graphics you need to put on for a football match are nowhere near as complex. In fact, sometimes it can be as simple as 1-0, 2-0. Usually in the case of my football team, it's telling me that they are in fact losing. But
it's all right. You had a decade where you won everything.
Yeah,
Christian.
Exactly. We'll move on from that.
Pack away your moans.
Quite quickly move on from that. I'm a Leicester City fan. Anyway, we can wildly off topic. Anyway, moving swiftly on. The TV graphics that we see on screen.
Yeah.
Two questions. Firstly, how helpful to you as a commentator are they? Because let's be honest, you know, sometimes viewers are seeing stuff from them and you will be too as the commentator. But secondly, we've got some new graphics this year as well. How have they changed things? How do they help you?
Well, you need them a lot this year because there are so many intangibles that, like in the state of the battery. Hmm. You've got to know whether someone's roared around the outside with the use of the battery or whether they've... And in the past, we had DRS. So no guessing because it was tangible and it was
there. Yeah, sure.
Obviously, we've got overtake mode this year and we've got different... You know, we've got boost, we've got different states of the battery being full, battery being empty. And so the graphics this year tell us that story in a way that we could see last year and previous years with DRS. So you're relying on the graphics in a different way. There are so many graphics that you get in Formula One compared to other sports as a result. And I do think when I watch other sports, the job that they do to break it down in a simple way. And to be honest, it sounds really, really daft, but when you see other stopwatch sports, you're so grateful for the left-hand side timing tower because that is so useful to just be able to glance down to and refer to. And we take that for granted. I wouldn't want to do my job without it.
It's quite funny because like when I'm watching at home, and I know it inevitably happens sometimes that there's a glitch, the timing tower disappears for a moment. The illogical reaction in my mind is ridiculous. What's happened? It's the end of the world. Where's the timing? I don't know what's happening. Of course I do. Fundamentally, the car in front's still winning. Yeah. But it's like, oh my word, what's happening? It must be difficult in those situations not to panic when things do go wrong. I panic when I'm sat watching, let alone you describing it to the world.
Well, you go back to your radio days. This happened in Bahrain last year. We lost the timing graphics for about 10 minutes. And I was like, my brain was just like, right, turn it into radio. Because everyone's got to know the time. You just mentioned the timings way more in that circumstance. But yeah, you do lean very heavily on the graphics.
You go back to your radio days. Right, let's check the travel news now. No, I'm joking. Right, in fact, I'll tell you what we will do, actually, rather than check the travel news, is we'll go for a short break. And then after that, we will put some of your questions to Alex Jakes. Back in a moment. Welcome back to F1 Explains, where this week we are explaining Formula One commentary. And we always say on F1 Explains, we find the best person in the paddock to answer those questions. So, of course, we thought go to a Formula One commentator. I'm joined by Alex Jakes, and we are in a commentary box. The best man for the job in the best place. Let's go to some of your questions. F1explains@f1.com. Adam is in Pittsburgh. Hello, Adam. You're going to like Adam from Pittsburgh, Alex Jakes.
Go on.
I can tell you because his first question, well, it's a big question, and it starts with, how did Alex become so good at commentating?
it's a great question. We'll leave it there. Thanks so much.
It's a great question. Adam, the chair of the Alex Jakes fan club. Adam says, how did Alex become so good at commentating? What kind of prep does he have to do before the races? And is Alex always at the track or sometimes does he do commentary remotely? So 3-1 from Adam in Pittsburgh for you there, starting with your brilliance, Alex Jakes.
The fine people of Pittsburgh. I've always liked them. That's very kind of him to say. I appreciate that. A lot of work goes into it. It's a little bit like when I was describing with the timing pages. You're taking a lot of information and you're trying to distill it from about 30 pieces of A4 into two. So to describe for you, because it's the first race of the season, I've got the driver's T-cam colours very, very bright. You've got Verstappen has a black T-cam, Hadjar has a yellow T-cam.
And just for those brand new to F1, explain what a T-cam is.
Yeah, it's the camera on top of the car, and it's the most identifiable thing. We have to use that more than the crash helmets in modern times because the halo obscures the view.
Yes.
And you don't know what angle you're going to get. So as a result, that's up there as well. I have notes on every single driver and team. Essentially, it's about 10 facts. Some of them are about the journey that they've had across the weekend. Some of them are the basics, their previous results. But 10 things I can say. You never use all of that. You also have your grid. That will be in front of me. You also have the stats of their previous career. That's a page I do for myself as well. Again, just purely because I want to access the information exactly how I want it, so the time from me looking at the page to talking into the microphone is as short as possible. It means that I essentially have about 10 pieces of paper in front of me and then a thick chunk off to the side where you're sitting, Christian, where I can, if it gets into real detail and you get a shock win, then you're looking through your basically really detailed notes to access that information. And obviously I've got a laptop in front of me as well, because you never know what you're going to get in Formula One.
You never know.
What was the third part of the question?
The third part of the question was, is Alex always at the track, or does he sometimes do commentary remotely?
So this changed in 2020. When COVID hit, there was a necessity for many broadcast teams to do the commentary live remotely. It could happen in the past, but it was very, very difficult for that to take place. So most of the time before 2020, we'd always be on site every single event, looking out of the window at the track. Now it is different. We do about half from Formula One's Media and Technology Center in the UK and half on site. The reason for the split, it's nice to see your friends and family.
Yeah.
from time to time. And occasionally they're like, it'd be nice to see you from time to time. Also, Formula One's got sustainable goals, and it takes a lot to rig the equipment that we've described and ship it around the world. So we do some from the studio and some on site. You have to come on site because you just never know what you're going to learn when you run into someone. I was going to get a coffee this morning in our facility, very quickly ran into George Russell. Okay, there is something I'm going to say about that quick interaction in the broadcast. It's shaped my thinking about the narrative. If I'm back in the studio, I don't have that. I don't have that insight. It doesn't make it onto the broadcast. So you can never fully do it remotely without losing the journalistic steer of what's going on. But yeah, for half of them, we're at track and half we're back at base.
And that journalistic steer, as you say, is balanced, isn't it, with an increase in technology that we've seen partly sort of spearheaded by COVID. You almost sound a jovial there, but there is a genuine point, isn't there, in the Formula One world nowadays, if there have been 24 races, of people's well-being and making sure you're not spending too much time on planes. You know, in the original days that you and I grew up watching Formula One, Alex, there was 17 races a season. That's considerably less tricky for a commentator doing 17 races. So there is also that. And as well, as you say, the environmental measures, it does mean that fewer of us have to get on planes, which really helps. I also really enjoyed your point about the facts you have on the drivers, because when I was doing football reporting, my rule was 3 facts to say on each player.
Yeah.
I think I would probably use about 4% of that information by the end of the broadcast, but it's just there in case you need something to say.
And yet we're recording this at the opening race of the year. I was up at 6 a.m. I get to the... For opening race day of the year, I get in super early because I want my notes done. Once my notes are done, you can relax, you can enjoy. Until they're done, doesn't matter if we use... As you say, you would use 5%, 10% of what was in front of you. Until it's done, you're not ready to go on air. And that's just the nature of the gig.
Absolutely. Cameron from Canada says, I know the cars have numbers on them and a lot of the drivers have helmets that stand out, but with cars moving so fast, camera angles so varied and those numbers not being massive, how do you identify the drivers when commentating? You've given us one answer to this with the T-cam and the colours of the T-cam. Are there any other tips and hints?
Well, you can still see on the onboards, obviously, you can still see the driver's helmet and that will give you a steer. But I'll give you an example of McLaren this weekend. Oscar Piastri is running more yellow on his helmet. It's his home race. It looks very, very similar to Lando Norris's crash helmet. So if
goodness sake, Oscar.
So if there's a McLaren in the wall at some point of the race, I'm looking to the camera at the top of the car because there's not enough difference between the crash helmets to identify them that way. Numbers wise, you would just never use the number because you don't know what angle you're going to get. It's not like other championships where there are enormous numbers on the side of the car. And, you know, for example, oval racing on the side of the car, you're going to be able to use that a lot more. So that's not a luxury that we have, as useful as it would be, certainly on the opening laps. But yeah, so you're usually, you know that Max Verstappen's got a flash of red on his crash helmet and Hadjar hasn't. So you're looking at that and then you're confirming it with the camera on the top of the car. That's how I'm doing driver ID.
I guess also there must be an element of the truth to set you free, because sometimes in sports you won't know. It might be that there is a plume of smoke. It might be that you can't see from the particular camera angle. I remember, I go back to my football reporting, the first ever game I did for the BBC in the UK, BBC One, the big network broadcaster, and the first goal I had to report on was scored and my entire vision was obscured by a pole that kept the stadium upright. I could not see for the life of me what had happened, and it was my first thing to report. And then you do have to sometimes in sport be honest with your audience, don't you, and go, I'm not sure what's happened here, but we'll find out. I guess there's an element of honesty.
Yeah, there's an element of trying to cover that up as long as you possibly can.
Yeah,
and seasoned viewers will know that you start padding and you're like, when Verstappen spun off yesterday, for the Australian Grand Prix where we're recording this, my brain was like, second Red Bull, Hadjar's off.
Yes, understandably so, with the greatest of respect to Isaac Hadjar.
Because of the second Red Bull, because of how things have been, because Max Verstappen has never in my brain spun off and qualifying and hit a wall. But you're like, check it again. You've got to say who it is in the wall now. It's Max Verstappen. And then you hope that you've not just misidentified it or seen it wrong, or the clouds not come over at the wrong moment. And it was different. But yeah, it's tricky to do, especially given, if you get something dramatic like that, it's usually a jump cut. It's a crash zoom, or it's a car flying sideways. And yeah, you're not being able to use the number.
Lovely question, Cameron. Thank you for that. Don't forget, F1 Explains at F1.com to send your questions on anything F1 related. A lovely one here. By the way, we've collected these over the course of the last season. So many questions came in on commentary last season, Alex. This is a lovely one from Yergos in Athens. Yergos says, why are the microphones in the commentary box the way they are? Now, I'm sure Yergos here has seen when you, Alex, you appear in vision on F1 TV's broadcasts and from your commentary box, where you're using a particular type of microphone. We've got one on the desk in front of us. Describe what he means here, Alex.
Yeah, he's talking about a lip mic, which, funnily enough, held to your top lip. They've had about the same design since the 1940s,
it's like
really.
The war, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's got this old school texture to it. It is essentially a directional microphone that can be used in very loud environments. And so that's why it looks so distinctive. There's been no real need to redesign it through the years because it does work so well. Commentators get a sort of rhythm with it. So I like to use the old school mic. That's what I've done for the 11 years I've been broadcasting on motorsport. Along this commentary box row, Crofty, for example, prefers a headset. And that's just the rhythm that he's got into. That's what he wants to use.
And we wish you well with it.
And then obviously when we get to testing, when we combine the teams, the amount of swapping over is ridiculous because again, it's you want to be comfortable and you want to do that. And so, yeah, it's a directional microphone and it looks old school because it is old school and the design was so good in the 1940s, they never needed to change it.
And Alex and his co-commentators have the luxury of microphones each, but there are famous stories from the 70s of Formula One where the late, great Murray Walker, whose commentary you'll have heard, he used to share his commentary box with many great drivers, including the British world champion James Hunt, where they used to have to share a microphone and got into many heated arguments because of that, whereas you don't have to grab your microphone off Jolyon Palmer. You're fortunate.
Can you imagine the... the aggro and arguments. There's a great story that Murray Walker put in his autobiography about how he had the microphone yanked out of his hand by James Hunt and pulled back his fist to punch him. Because
which is the least Murray Walker thing ever.
Or the nicest man in the history of broadcasting. But like, you have the microphone yanked out of your hand. Murray used to stand, treat it like a performance sport. James Hunt sitting down, feet up. Yanks it out of his hand, and his producer wags his finger and goes, "Don't hit your co-commentator." Love the BBC. Sharing a microphone, what on earth were they thinking?
Yeah, even
what
in those times.
What on earth were they thinking? Well,
it's a huge coincidence, because our next question is, when have you felt most likely to punch Julian Palmer? No, I'm joking, of course, I'm joking.
I've been working with him a while. I'm just used to his antics at this point.
Yeah, just let him get on with it. Although, actually, Cameron from Glasgow, his question, which is our next one, is around F1 commentary and punditry. He says, what I would like to know is, how does it work? Is it the former driver's full-time job? And how are drivers selected for their commentary and expertise? So, yes, of course, Alex, you commentate with the former Formula One drivers, Julian Palmer and David Coulthard. There are so many examples up and down the paddock of ex-drivers. Yeah, how does it work? How do they get picked? How do they find their way into this?
You have to essentially have performed at a level that gives you the ability to pass judgment. Mm. But the CV alone is not enough. You've got to be a quality broadcaster. And if you're going to be a pundit, you've got to be prepared to be unpopular sometimes. You've got to say it like it is. You've also got to have an ability to take very complex subjects and be able to explain them to... And this year's rules are a perfect example of it. So essentially, you've got to have a great turn of phrase. You've got to make the complicated very simple and accessible to understand. You've got to have a bit of flair with your phraseology.
Yeah.
It's no good just being great but dry.
We're in entertainment.
And long-winded. You've got to be able to sell it to everyone at home. I've been so fortunate through the years to have genuinely world-class sports broadcasters who happen to have driven around in circles for a long time beforehand. But a CV alone is not enough. You've got to be a great broadcaster, and you've got to, and honestly, I think this is the key, you've got to want to be a great broadcaster. When this is not their first career. For some sporting pundits, this is not where they wanted to be at this stage. But the great broadcasters... who are sports co-commentators and pundits and summarizers and analyzers work at not just what they knew, but obtaining information, and they work at the broadcast skill.
I'm going to add to that, if you don't mind, Alex. I know there's some swapping roles.
I'll tell you at the end.
Yeah. I often think sometimes watching at home, people think, well, the great. Whether it be Formula One drivers or football players, make great commentators. For example, there is no, just because he's won 7 world championships, there's no guarantee that Lewis Hamilton would make a brilliant co-commentator. We've got some fantastic examples of this within our team here in Formula One, where Julian Palmer and James Hinchcliffe are two examples I will use, who were excellent racing drivers, but... Julian will be the first to admit, didn't win world championships in Formula One, but is a world-class, outstanding, not just broadcaster, because he's a great presenter, he's led commentary sessions. James Hinchcliffe presents F1 TV, but they're also so good at explaining and unpacking.
Yeah.
And the two things don't necessarily always go hand in hand. You can have someone that has done everything in a sport, but can't necessarily describe that on air.
Yeah, and you don't have that automatically. You have that by trying at it.
It's really annoying.
Oh, it's so annoying.
With Hinch and Julian, both very nice men, very talented racing drivers.
No, it winds
Hinch
me
can
up.
Only dance. It can dance as well. It's just, it's not on, because like sort of talking sort of the only thing I'm even half good at. It's frankly a disgrace. Anyway, looking forward to Hinch coming back on the podcast soon. Alex, your relationship with these guys who sit next to you, you're with them for hours at a time over a race weekend. Does it maintain and build differently?
It helps if you get on.
I imagine.
Yeah, it's a very, very strange one, because I grew up watching DC on the telly, and then you're having to, ask him the questions. If something controversial happens, sometimes you're having to ask questions that maybe he would want to stay away from, but he's got to give a verdict on, because everyone at home is thinking, what does David Coulthard think about this controversial incident? So that's quite fun. No, I'm very, very lucky in that I've not only been... This is a good point, and I'm glad you've raised this. I've been very fortunate in that I've been sat next to people who are genuinely great people and wonderful to spend time with and travel the world with, as well as great broadcasters.
Yes.
And not always the same thing.
No, no.
So that's been a treat, and it makes life a lot easier. The one thing I'm adamant about that you need is you need warmth in a commentary. Everyone at home is giving you their weekend. You don't want to be like, oh, it's terrible. Oh, I should have passed him. Oh, no, you don't want to be the paddock police. You want to be fun to hang out with. And I've been very fortunate in that the camaraderie you'll hear on air is real.
We've both been told off by paddock police at various points. You do spend a lot of your time in Formula One getting told off for being in somewhere you shouldn't be or accidentally yeah. going to. Yes. Sorry.
Yeah.
And you don't want that on air. Alex, we're nearly done, but just before we go, we see and hear your clips of commentary on those big moments. So let's talk about the most recent one. For example, when you're crowning a new world champion. Mm. We obviously crowned Lando Norris as our world champion at the end of 2025. You know, when you're going into that Abu Dhabi race, you know, I'm going to crown a new world champion here. How much do you think about that? How much do you think about those moments where it's like, okay, this is big? Or is it best to just not think about it? How do you go about the real big moments that you know, okay, something big's happening here?
You think about the elements, but you don't. So going into the last race in Abu Dhabi, I'm thinking of points that I might want to hit for each three drivers. Mm. So to run you through, before the lights went out in Abu Dhabi, my rough thinking was, if Max wins, it's the comeback of all comebacks. So I'm probably going to lead with that. If Lando wins, I thought the element of him staying loyal to McLaren when he could have left for a Red Bull seat was really interesting.
Sure.
And for Oscar Piastri, the idea that he, you know, it would slip through his fingers and he'd get it back, that what a turnaround kind of thing. How you say it has to fit the moment. And I'm absolutely adamant about this. How you communicate that has to fit. And there's a great example from Abu Dhabi 2021 where you can have all of the planning and you can come up with all of the ideas of what you might say, but because the ending was so unexpected, the words have to fit the moment. And it's as an example of, so you think of the elements that you might want to highlight, but the formation and the phraseology has to come in the moment because it's got to fit the pictures. And it's got to fit how it feels to everyone at home. You can't crowbar your own thing in.
Alex Shakes, it is a joy to hear you commentate, and I sincerely mean that. So thank you for guiding us through the wonderful world of Formula One. And also thank you for taking the time to answer our listeners' questions on a busy race weekend, because as I say, that is just some of the questions we've had on commentary over the last few months. So we appreciate your time, Alex Shakes. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me on the podcast. And as you can tell, I absolutely love talking about commentary. So this has been a joy.
Oh, good. Excellent. Well, it's been a joy to do. Thank you very much, Alex Jakes. We have new episodes of F1 Explains every Friday. And of course, new for this season, we're on the same feed as F1 Nation. So hit follow, like, or subscribe for race previews and race debriefs with Tom Clarkson. And we have new episodes of F1 Explains every Friday. We'll be back next Friday, of course. So do send us your questions, F1explains@f1.com. And we'll answer more of them soon. From here in Australia. Bye for now.